copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I want to begin this morning from a biblical note before we dive into these. What we're going to be considering today is briefly in each of these, because we have so little time on this. How is mindfulness used in counseling? I'm just going to give you three examples of that. Then the question of what's the research on mindfulness? Does it actually work? What is biblical meditation and mindfulness? We'll begin to touch on that. And then and in the middle of all this, we're going to enter into some Buddhist philosophy and psychology, which is the most complex bit, that I hope you will follow me in that as I wrestle with it myself. So here we are. We're slowing down, hopefully, not multitasking. You're not doing your emails. You're not doing your texts on your phones, hopefully. We're bringing our awareness down to focus on this particular topic. So we're mindfully approaching this topic of mindfulness. And I want you just to sit still for a moment and reflect. You could do this, obviously you can do this on your own. Just to be still and know that He is God. Just for you for a moment, what does it mean? I sat out in the sunshine just before I went into the Bible study and just felt like I was sitting in the glow of God's presence, and a whole lot of words about His character came just flowing into my mind. But just be still and know that He is God. The critical part of this is that it's in relationship. And that is a profound distinction between Christian mindfulness, meditation, and Buddhist mindfulness, as we will see as we go into this. And it's about relationship with a God who is both out there, but also in here, the indwelling spirit. And we are called as Christians to contemplate the whole of reality from God's perspective. And obviously we begin with Scripture, the book, this book shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do all that is written in it. And it's obviously not just about law and legalism, but in that book you find who God is, and you find the message of His love and His grace to us. You find how important it is to be in relationship, that we're made in His image for relationship, for dominion over this earth. I love this Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of Psalm 46 in the Message. He says, "Attention all, see the marvels of God. He plants flowers and trees all over the earth. He's mindfully looking at the creation. Step out of the traffic. Take a long, loving look at me, your high God, above politics, above everything." This is the being still and knowing that He is God. Stopping the multitasking. Stilling your mind in His presence. So, This is just a beginning look at some biblical meditation. We'll come back to some other passages. But what we looked at yesterday were the basics of mindfulness, of centering down, initially focusing on your breathing to bring your attention to one place, opening up then to an awareness of sounds, sensations, ideas, thoughts, images going on inside you, and then observing them, watching them come and go as a part of getting to know yourself, your body, your thoughts. And initially, don't judge and evaluate or interpret, but stay with it. Live in the moment. Let it be. Notice it. So it's the noticing, it's the awareness that is the sort of core discipline of mindfulness. I can give you a PDF version of these slides later, so you don't need to feel you've got to write down every little detail, because I know these are full. We looked yesterday at Terry Fralick's sort of very down-to-earth view of mindfulness, of the stopping, paying attention to negative reactions, the breathing, the releasing of the tension, allowing the negative, the tension, the frustration, the anger, the anxiety to soften. And then to reflect, what are the patterns in this? What are the false beliefs, the lies that I'm believing that make me feel this way? What's happening inside other people? So making you more mindful of them, not just of yourself. And then what is the loving, respectful, skillful response? Not fighting, not fleeing, not freezing now, but being able to choose a little more because you've become more self-aware. Let me give you, I like this little summary here of mindfulness. Oop, I need to plug in sound. Hopefully we'll have it. Do we have to turn it on? It's in that. Oh, it was over there yesterday. I remembered her doing it. Let's see. Yeah, good. Thank you.
You may have heard this word mindfulness. It's become something of a buzz phrase of late.
Now, turn it up just a
little. Simple, serviceable definition, which is this: mindfulness is the ability to know what's happening in your head at any given moment without getting carried away by it. Imagine how useful this could be. Just as an example, driving down the road and somebody cuts you off in traffic. How do you normally react? I think most of us, we normally react by having a thought, which is, I'm pissed. You immediately, habitually, reflexively inhabit that thought. You actually become pissed. There's no buffer between the stimulus and your reaction. With just a little bit of mindfulness, in that same situation, you might notice my chest is buzzing, my ears are turning red, I'm having a starburst of self-righteous thoughts, I'm getting angry. But you don't necessarily have to act on it and chase that person down the road screaming at them with your kids in the back of the car thinking you've gone nuts. Now, you might be thinking, don't I need to get angry sometimes? Aren't I justified? I would say yes, but probably not as much as you think. The proposition here is not that you should be rendered by mindfulness into some lifeless, non-judgmental blob. The proposition is that you should learn how to respond wisely to things that happen to you, rather than just reacting blindly. And that, my friends, is a superpower. How do you get it? The way to get it is through meditation. I believe that meditation and mindfulness are the next big public health revolution. In the 1940s, if you told somebody you were going running, they would have said, "Who's chasing you?" But then what happened next? The scientists swooped in. They showed that physical exercise is really good for you. And now all of us do it. And if we don't, we feel guilty about it. And that's where I think we're headed with mindfulness and meditation. It's going to join the pantheon of no-brainers like brushing your teeth, eating well, and taking the meds your doctor prescribed for you. But let me just close by saying, mindfulness is not going to solve all of your problems. It's not going to render your life a nonstop parade of unicorns and rainbows. Nonetheless, this is a superpower, and one that is accessible by you immediately.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a very neat little summary of a lot of what we've been talking about, and easily memorable. So we looked at the basics. So let's look just again. This is brief, but in thinking in particular, just to give some examples of what about with depression and with anxiety and with pain. So you can see how if mindfulness helps you with emotional regulation, affect regulation, and self-acceptance, it reduces your emotional reactivity. So when you're feeling full of anger, bitterness, sadness, whatever it is, you can sort of slow down and become aware of it and look at your sadness, look at your anger, look at your fears, and deal with them more slowly without just sort of identifying with them and embracing them and ruminating constantly about them. But that's a discipline. So this is what we're saying to patients, to clients, is I can't fix you. I can give you tools to help yourself to retrain your brain. You've got stuck in these deep grooves of rumination, of self-pity, of anger with others. And if you're going to begin to turn away from those and dig new paths in your brain, create new neural networks, have other neurons firing together that will eventually wire together, this is a discipline practice that you need to do every day, ideally maybe twice a day. Take some time. So mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, so it's a combination of mindfulness and cognitive therapy, claims to be more effective than meds in preventing relapse in depression. You remember what we talked about yesterday in relation to emotions. What we resist is often perpetuated. So there's an element here of acceptance, and then somehow the you accepting it, coming to terms with it and dealing with it in a more healthy way, rather than just fighting it, struggling with it all the time, helps it to sort of almost dissolve away. So it's part of a comprehensive approach with depression. First of all, careful taking of a history with the person. You sit down with them, you hear their story of how they got into it, why, and so on. You obviously have to assess risk with depression of self-harm. And if there is suicidal risk, you're not going to go straight into mindfulness. You're going to do other things, and you're going to make sure that they are safe, and so on. But so mindfulness is just one tool among many. It's not the big cure-all. It's one tool in your armor, in your armory of helping people. Other things like exercise, like social activities, other behavioral interventions, medication, all of those may be indicated. So you have to ask with each client, is mindfulness appropriate? And where in the process of therapy can we introduce it? But I would suggest that in most people with mild to moderate depression, it could be a useful tool. Have any of you used it in working with people with depression?
I had some people with depression that I use more like dancing and relational part. It really helps.
Yeah.
It really helps to keep them. And then it's all related to. But I will try this too. Slowly.
Yeah. It's just another part of it, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. If you think of anxiety, again, it's sort of the same core principles are there. So most of us have anxieties that have been conditioned by our environment to some degree, and partly by our own choices, where we have cultivated the habit of anxiety. But you may be a much more anxious person than most. Some people are. About you know, 30% of the population fall into the high anxiety category of temperament, about 30% in the low anxiety category. I heard these referred to in a research paper the other day as the high anxiety people are the orchids, the low anxiety are the dandelions, and the 40% in the middle are the tulips. Which is sort of a visual way of helping us to think about it.
But
orchids. Do you know orchid?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oh. A sensitive, beautiful flower, basically. But you, we're dealing in this with the sort of body reflexes of fight and flight or freeze, and we often develop very unhelpful ways to escape or avoid anxiety. So you may use, you know, drugs or pornography or overwork or all sorts of different ways. So this is just, again, a basic skill to help people to become more aware of their anxieties and not be so afraid of them. So in this quote here, when we simply accept fear just as it is, without our opinions, judgments, and reactions, fear is not nearly so frightening. So many patients with anxiety, panic attacks, phobias, they become afraid of being afraid. And a lot of our task is essentially exposure. And I think mindfulness is actually a form of exposure to anxiety. It's desensitizing them by befriending it. It's sort of saying, you don't need to see this as a huge enemy. You know, be aware of it. Be aware of its positive functions in your life, because you need some anxiety to fight and to flee. So there's a sort of acceptance and compassion with yourself. I'm not a bad person for feeling anxious. And I did the first part of my seminar on anxiety yesterday. There were several people in the group who said, in the church, you feel incredibly guilty and ashamed if you're anxious. You're seen as spiritually inferior. You're not trusting. But to be able to say this is a normal part of life that we need to learn to deal with. And obviously there are biblical principles to apply to our anxiety. But so educating people about what anxiety is and how it comes and what it does to us, and explaining the amygdala, you know, a little bit of the neuroanatomy is actually quite helpful to people. When they know they've got a fire alarm in there of the amygdala, and some people have an oversensitive fire alarm that goes off when it shouldn't, when there's only a little bit of smoke or a little bit of anxiety. Others have too low an amygdala that's been crushed. Teaching people emotional regulation and the language of inviting the difficulty in and working with it. So naming, some people use the, you know, call the anxiety or call the depression a name. Some people call the amygdala Amy. You know, so Amy's getting alarmed now. So you might give the actual anxiety, which helps to sort of separate it from your core identity. So this is experiencing it, tolerating it, without immediately running to avoiding. And you can't get through anxiety and fear without facing your anxieties. There's no other way. You have to go through them to get out the other side. So this is a form, I think, of exposure therapy, and it's in the context of relationship some of us desensitize ourselves naturally. You know, if you're afraid of flying and you don't give up flying, you keep flying, it's likely that you will fairly quickly desensitize yourself and get used to it. So a lot of exposure happens in life anyway. But in a therapeutic situation, you're helping the person to feel safe and giving them the tools to then deal with the anxiety. And this is, again, just one tool. Now, in the area of pain, and Marek has worked in pain clinics, so he may be able to tell us a little more on this, but here is a quote which is a story about the Buddha, a story that the Buddha tells, apparently, about the two arrows. When you're touched with the feeling of pain, whether it's back pain, headaches, whatever it is, the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, and becomes distraught. Now, this is especially true if, you know, if any of you have dealt with back pain, and your back goes into spasm, and you can't get up from the chair, and you begin to panic, and you, and every time you feel a twinge, you get terrified that this is going to happen again. And it becomes a psychological vicious circle of your fear of the pain. So he goes on, so he feels two pains, physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot him with an arrow and right afterwards were to shoot him with another one so that he would feel the pain of two arrows. So he's saying you multiply your own suffering. So a lot of the principles of dealing with, for example, back pain, are that you have to deal, that there may be structural damage in the back, and many people have, when you scan their backs, they have all sorts of structure. You look at mine and my neck, there's all sorts of damage due to age in it. But people have this irrational fear which makes them tense up. They misinterpret their symptoms, thinking, you know, this is a, I've got a terrible disc problem in my prolapsed disc. And some people might have a prolapsed disc, but many people with back pain don't necessarily have a physical cause for it. The pain is maintained by the psychological tension. But they start to stop exercising, limiting their activity, which is the very last thing that you, the very worst thing for it. So educating people about the psychological and physical structures and helping them to resume physical activity. We used to tell people with back pain to lie on their backs for a week and just rest. Nowadays, it's completely opposite. You mobilize people immediately. You get them into a structured exercise program. You work with their negative emotions and help them to accept and to notice the pain, but not immediately tense up and fight it. It's that same principle again as we talked about with emotions. Now, Marek, what in what ways were you using it in the pain clinic that you worked in?
Mindfulness? Well, the trouble with our clinic was that we had quite a little time to work with the patients, so we couldn't see them on a regular basis. So mindfulness was easy for me to give them, like explain the basic ideas and see how they like relate to it, and then give them a book with a CD that they can follow up, like work with. It's like an 8-week program for some extroverted people who need more interaction. I arranged a meeting with people who organize courses, like group mindfulness. And then I would just see how they follow up on that. So some of the patients were more like engaged and intelligent, and even some of them had the most pain, decided to run their own courses of mindfulness in the future for other people like them, which was interesting. I think for chronic pain patients, it's crucial somehow for them to learn to distinguish between the pain itself and try to experience their body as an ally in just keeping the pain within itself and somehow distancing it from the mind, building that paradoxical stance where the mind is watching and is fully present and at the same time is not the same as pain itself. It's just a part of the experience. Mm-hmm. So that there is no more necessary mental pain than needed. So that's how we would work in different ways. I also do work with imagination and trance sometimes, so I kind of use the same principles and working with the people right alongside, but we usually didn't have much time for that. So
right.
Usually it was
right.
Cognitive restructuring and thinking around that, how to help them accept these mm-hmm. thinking and mm-hmm. So that they can work on their own as well. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Great. Thank you. Yeah, I think the concept of sort of separating yourself to some degree, obviously when you feel pain, it is a part of you, but it's not the whole of you. It doesn't become your right. It doesn't need to become your whole identity and to take over your whole life. And I think mindfulness can help to create some of that distance. So those are three areas, and you can see, so it's a sort of a relatively simple thing that in each type of problem has to be applied individually to the client and to their particular need and situation. So here's a quote from a book called Mindfulness and Psychotherapy that I've used actually a lot in thinking about this. A whole lot of different chapters by different people in it, where they say, when our habitual emotional reactions are held in mindful awareness and become less repetitive, a quiet joy begins to arise within us. Therapists who have tasted this calm joy implicitly teach their patients that happiness can emerge in spite of the conditions of our lives, that we can live more fully right here, right now, in the midst of inevitable challenges. So it's sort of giving people the tools to live in the midst of suffering and not necessarily saying, we're going to take away all your suffering. It's learning to live in and with suffering and deal with it better. And so it's, in a way, it's more like the biblical concept of contentment rather than happiness. Happiness is this sort of ethereal thing that we're all chasing, that the more you chase it, the less you get it. Contentment is more, I'm living in a difficult world, things are hard, but I'm learning to deal with them in a more effective way. So, so let me move now to the question of what evidence is there that it works. The early research on this, when it was more the sort of the Buddhist monks were all over the news, and there were pictures of monks like this with EEG, electroencephalogram electrodes on their heads, where they were being measured, their brainwaves were being measured. So they compared long-time Buddhist monks who were had been meditating for years with a control group who had just 1 week of training in mindfulness meditation. And what they claim is that the long-time meditators had large, well, the way they put it is large-scale coordination of neural circuits, meaning they're more integrated, their neural circuits are working together better, whereas the short-term meditators were nowhere near as integrated, although they were better than those who didn't meditate at all. Another study looked at people before, after, and at 4 months of mindfulness meditation, and they found this persistent increased activity in the left prefrontal cortex, which is associated with joyful and serene emotions. So it's possible that just they were more peaceful. And then it also, interestingly, they had increased antibody responses compared with the control group to a flu vaccine. So there was a physical effect of boosting the immune function of the body. So these were some of the earlier ones. Now I've looked at more recent in the last four or five years and this is one called the Neuroscience of Mindfulness Meditation, and they're, and I'm just giving you the conclusions here, but you have the references if you want to go to them. They talk about there's broad support of the beneficial effects on physical and mental health, but, and in all the research that I've read, there are caveats like this that said, but we need much more rigorous studies to understand the neural mechanisms of what's going on. We don't really know very clearly. But what they claim in a lot of these research studies is a whole list of neurological changes. And you don't need to know all about these, but this is just an example of, let me just read a few of them. So increased density and activity in the prefrontal cortex, which is obviously where we're dealing with particularly a lot of emotional stuff. Decreased size and activity in the amygdala, so the alarm is turned down. Increased connection between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex, so you have more emotional regulation. Reduced stress response, so more reduced amount of cortisol and adrenaline released. Increased GABA. GABA is a neurotransmitter that has a calming effect on the brain. And sort of general integration in the brain. Now, another research study sort of throws in question how much we can trust all of this. And so I'm still holding lightly some of the research. I'm not, until there is more detailed research. Here's a review in 2014 and a meta-analysis. Now, you know what a meta-analysis is, where it looks at lots and lots of studies, hundreds of studies, and basically winnows them, sorts them out, and says which of these are good studies. Where do they have reliable control group? Where is there no vested interest? Did the people who do the research, were they the ones who were actually doing the training in mindfulness? Were they the ones who paid for the research? And they came out of 18,743 trials. They said there were 47 good ones. That's a pretty general view of psychological research in the 2018. There have been several articles and books written about this, of how bad the quality of research is becoming. So don't just trust just because it's in a scientific paper. You need to learn how to read scientific papers. But they did say there's moderately strong evidence that mindfulness meditation had a small but consistent benefit in relieving anxiety, depression, and pain. Depression relieved 10 to 20% of the time. An Oxford study done a few years ago said that it was better than in helping relapse than in severe depression than medication. But I've seen recently some questions about the methodology in that study. another one in 2015, a long article, systematic review and meta-analysis. Their conclusion was this: although there is continued skepticism in the medical world towards mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, the evidence indicates that both are associated with improvements in depressive symptoms, anxiety, stress, quality of life, and selected physical outcomes in the adjunct treatment of cancer, cardiovascular disease, chronic pain, chronic somatic diseases, depression, anxiety disorders, other mental disorders, and in prevention of healthy adults and children, in prevention of these diseases for them. So again, some evidence. It's not, intensely powerful. And then the most recent one I read was in Scientific American Mind, where they devoted a whole article to this question just a few months ago, and they quoted this article from 2015. 15 prominent psychologists and cognitive scientists caution that despite its popularity and supposed benefits, scientific data on mindfulness is woefully lacking. Many of the studies on mindfulness and meditation, the authors wrote, are poorly designed, compromised by inconsistent definitions of what mindfulness actually is, and often void of a control group to rule out the placebo effect. So, we hear all about mindfulness and all its benefits, and it's being advertised and marketed, just be a little skeptical. There's a healthy Christian scientific skepticism. The question is, what is known about placebo effect in relation to this? All therapeutic methods work. And there are some people who respond to the placebo effect. You know, whether it's there's a powerful placebo effect with antidepressants, with anti-anxiety pills. I think meditation could have a very powerful placebo effect. Now, is it wrong to use it then? Maybe sometimes it's okay to take advantage of suggestion. We are suggestible creatures. But I think we have to be really honest, though, in acknowledging maybe this is placebo effect and not actually a specific effect of this medication or of this meditation technique. So you're right. I mean, the placebo effect is powerful. The West tends to view this as a quick fix tool. But interestingly, the East and quite a lot of Buddhists are actually upset by the way it's being used in the West. They view it as a lifelong practice in their rich spiritual, ethical, and social framework. And this is what Mary Wiley, that journalist who I quoted yesterday, says in the Psychotherapy Networker: while meditation has been acclaimed and sold as a quick, no-risk, easily mastered technique to achieve just about any conceivable desired goal, health, happiness, freedom from physical or mental pain, relaxation, self-confidence, career success, sexual success, inner peace, world peace, in fact, it is a far deeper, more complex, and less well-understood process than most people realize. So at one level, it's common sense, and we are using it like that. To the Buddhist, it's a way of life. And maybe we can, from a Christian perspective, adopt it as part of our way of life. It reminds us of some things about spirituality and prayer and meditation that we maybe have forgotten in the Christian world. But so I think what we're saying, where I've got to in this at this point, is that mindfulness is an aspect of God's good creation that has been adopted largely in the secular world within a false framework of reality. So it's something that is in itself good, and people can find healing without God. Yeah? So the common grace gift of healing, people can be cured of pneumonia with antibiotics. That's a common grace gift of God's healing. They can be cured of anxiety or helped with anxiety. A deeper level of healing, of course, comes in the gospel in relation to God. A deeper healing for anxiety is definitely in listening to the biblical principles and ultimately putting your trust in God, who is the sovereign Lord of the universe. But our task, I think, is reclaiming and using mindfulness within a Christian framework of reality. There is a website in the UK, christianmindfulness.co.uk, I think, which has a whole range of mindfulness tools and teaching about Christian mindfulness. I think it's .co.uk. Something like that. If you Google Christian mindfulness, you'll find it. And it's taking very much this same view. But something good may lead us in the wrong direction towards another reality. And this is where we need to go into the other reality, that it may take... If you're not discerning... If you give it to non-Christians, even Christians who are not very firm in their faith, and they go off to mindfulness classes in a secular environment, they may get somewhat confused by the view of reality that they're being introduced to. So the question is it Buddhist or Christian? And both Buddhism and Christianity are asking these big questions. What's our true nature? Why do we suffer? What is reality? Who am I? Why have compassion in the world? If we have gratitude, to whom or to what do we have gratitude? Does God exist? Who or what is God? And the answers intriguingly overlap. And this is where the confusion comes. And if you're not familiar with Eastern mysticism and Hindu and Buddhist ideas, this is not easy stuff. But I'll try and explain it simply. Buddhist mindfulness, mindfulness really was introduced into the world through Buddhism in the form it is now. It's a meditation technique introduced by the Buddha 2,500 years ago. It's a part of what is called vipassana, of insight meditation. And you can see there what the Buddhists encourage you towards is right understanding of the world, right thought, right speech, and so on. And one of these, of course, is right mindfulness, the seventh of the noble paths. So it's a mental discipline aimed to achieve uninterrupted mindfulness for the purpose of reaching a heightened level of spiritual awareness. Now, this is what people teaching yoga would say. You ultimately, if you do yoga properly, you will learn that it is designed as a physical exercise to awaken the kundalini energy, as they call it, in the lower part of your back, your sacrum, which then rises up through various levels to your brain and gives you an experience of enlightenment, which is where you see that the ultimate nature of everything is one. So this is the sort of higher Vedanta form of Hinduism. Now, you can practice yoga without getting into the whole worldview, and it can be very... I practice yoga as a physical exercise. It's very helpful and healthy. But I do not... It doesn't take me into that whole other worldview. And this is the same with mindfulness. You can do it without taking you into the Buddhist worldview of... But the purpose of mindfulness comes out when we begin to look at the Buddha's questions. Now, if you remember, Prince Siddhartha Gautama, who was the Buddha, was raised in a wealthy royal family 2,500 years ago in Nepal with everything he wanted. He was protected from seeing suffering living in this very wealthy palace. At the age of 29, he left the palace one day and saw on successive days a very sick person, a decrepit old man, and finally a dead body. And so he decided to leave the palace in search of the answer of why is there suffering. And he learned to meditate over the next 6 years, discovering that it is the mind that creates suffering, and thus achieved enlightenment. And he sat down under the Bodhi tree and had this experience of enlightenment, and then went on for the next 45 years tirelessly teaching all that he had learned. And this state of mind of enlightenment is free from disturbing emotions and expresses itself through fearlessness, joy, and active compassion. And the Buddhist monks who are seeking enlightenment go around with their begging bowls. They spend a lot of the day enlightening, but they live off other people. So he was asking this critical question, which any sentient being asks: why do we suffer? It's where many people begin when they're looking at Christianity. How do we relieve suffering? And here's a picture of the sort of demons around the Buddha under his tree, of lust and pride and fear, trying to draw him away from his enlightenment. Now, a more contemporary version of the Buddhist philosophy is this comes out in Tara Brach's book, Radical Acceptance, Embracing Your Life with the Heart of a Buddha. And she says, we discover the wholeness, wisdom, and love that are our deepest nature. She says, for all of us, the path of befriending our experience, that's what we've been talking about, requires great gentleness and patience as we learn to meet whatever arises in our body, heart, and mind with radical acceptance. We discover a precious freedom. Rather than being identified as a defended and insufficient self, we come to trust what Buddhists call our Buddhist nature, the awareness and love that are our true essence. Notice this. The awareness and love that are our true essence. We discover the wholeness, wisdom, and love that are our deepest nature. So, wholeness, wisdom, and love that are our deepest nature. So essentially, underneath the facade, you are perfect the way you are. There's a story of a Buddha that was found in Thailand many years ago, big statue that was all black and muddy, covered with mud. And everyone wondered why this was so. And one day someone went up and touched the Buddha with a wet hand, and some of this blackness came off. And underneath they discovered that the Buddha actually was gold. That's the true nature underneath who we are.
Once we remove our facade.
What?
Once we remove our facade.
Once you remove the facade, right, and get in touch with it. So here we have this comparison between the Christian and the Buddhist notion of true nature. So the Buddhists would say we are ignorant of our true nature. We're living out of our false nature. And if we could only discover and live in our deepest and truest nature, we would be loving and compassionate and kind and wouldn't feel anxieties and so on. We as Christians would say, we are a combination of true and false. We are a combination of dignity and depravity, of old nature and new nature. But our new nature is one because we are united with Christ and given his nature, his righteousness. It's not something that is inherent. And do you feel here something of the tension of the language overlaps in terms of talking about true and false nature? But we are not perfect the way we are we? And however much we deal with that, we don't get down to a core of our perfection. We are fallen beings.
In a way, that's also like the Buddhist thoughts about that is also like the humanist, right? Like that our core is good, that we are basically...
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is that. Yeah. And your problem is not moral rebellion. Mm-hmm. It's ignorance. And if you could see and be enlightened to your true state, then you would know. Then you would be naturally good. So one Buddhist teacher says, purity means that our true nature is already perfect and complete. None of our confusion and fear can change this inner purity. It doesn't get worse when we suffer or improve, when we become enlightened like the Buddha. We don't need to add anything to it or take anything away, nor do we have to do something to get it. It's here with us each and every moment, like a diamond in the palm of one's hand. And then the monk I quoted yesterday, Thich Nhat Hanh, puts it this way in his little poem. Our true home is in the present moment. To live in the present moment is a miracle. The miracle is not to walk on water. The miracle is to walk on the green earth in the present moment, to appreciate the peace and beauty that are available now. Peace is all around us and within us, in the world and in nature, and within us, in our bodies and our spirits. Once we learn to touch this peace, we will be healed and transformed. It's not a matter of faith, it is a matter of practice. So it is the spiritual discipline of mindfulness that gets you to this place of awareness and realization of your true nature. and liberates the compassion and gratitude and other these other things in you.
Hidden potentials.
Hidden potentials. Right, right. So as I think about Buddhism and Christianity and mindfulness, there's this area of CGW, the common grace wisdom bit. This is where they overlap and where there are things that are true that the Buddhist is saying, but you need discernment because the Buddhist diagnosis and prescription overlaps with the Christian one like this. We're made in the image of God, and even if you don't believe in a personal God, as the Buddhists don't, you still can't escape from the reality in which you live. So certain human reactions happen. It's how we explain human reactions. It's how we try to cure painful human, how we try to deal with suffering. Now, to make this a little more complex and to delve a little more deeply into Buddhism, Buddhists talk about the Four Noble Truths. Have any of you studied Buddhism at all? You have a little dick? You have a little bit? The first one, the human condition involves suffering. We all suffer. We can agree with that one? That's true to Christianity and Buddhism, isn't it? Where the suffering comes from is a different issue. The cause of suffering, the Buddhist would say, is craving because we get attached. We become greedy. We hate because we covet. We're deluded about the nature of reality. And we value things in this world too much.
We get attached to the things.
The things, the people, our dreams, our goals, our ambitions. But all is a passing show. So none of this is really going to last. You can't control life, so just accept it as it is, and don't grasp and get attached. But is there also a parallel, something that is the same as what the Buddhists are saying? We are called to attachment and to relationship. So we in some areas we do become attached because we're greedy and covetousness and lustful. And it is good to detach and to let go and to say, I can't be in control of the whole world. Yeah? But there's a subtle difference because you can't detach from everything. Right. To God, and there is a right dependence and relationship on people. One time many years ago, I went to a Buddhist monastery in Hampshire in England. And I sat down in front of this gigantic statue of the Buddha and a beautiful Tibetan rug with a Buddhist nun, Buddhist monk. And I said to him, so tell me, in relation to this attachment, I love my wife, I am deeply attached to her. If she should die, I would be very upset. I would grieve. I would feel pain. Is it right that I feel pain in that? And he just laughed.
Laughed.
However you say it. And I think it's because it was a moment of tension between reality and his attempt to say, no, you shouldn't. If you were not so attached to your wife, you wouldn't feel pain. But your suffering comes because you were too attached. So then they go on, suffering can be reduced or eliminated by changing our attitude. So no attachment, no craving. Now, as we've said, that's a partial truth, isn't it? We do. And the irony is that the Buddhist, I think, would never say to a mother, you know, you shouldn't be being attached to your child or the child attached to you, because they would see the value in love. So there are inconsistencies which are hard to live with. And then so the road out of suffering is a gradual awareness of having one's mind renewed. So this is biblical language, but it depends what direction your mind is going. What are you being renewed into? So we're training, they would say, to become more mindful and aware so that we suffer less. And then they would go on to say, we are also trying to cultivate virtue. We want to have basic gentleness. We want to tame our minds and learn how to manage our suffering and transcend our selfishness. Which again is, that's what we want as Christians, isn't it? But you're trying to help people to reduce their desire so that they are comfortable all the time, cultivating an ability to accept things as they are. We want to notice our feelings like boredom and frustration, but to avoid attaching to them. Again, there's truth in this, isn't there? There's truth in that we need to accept things that we can't change as they are, and that we don't want to get too attached to self-pity or frustration or boredom so that they become our whole identity. And that contentment is something that Christians, you know, godliness with contentment, says Scripture, is great gain. So this is our sense of accepting things as they are. The problem comes in the Buddhist view, I think, is that they're so accepting that many Buddhists who are involved in mindfulness meditation retreat from being concerned about the suffering of the world. Now, not all of them, and we'll see that in a moment. But if you just look at the difference between the Christian and the Buddhist view, so the Christian says suffering comes out of the fall, and we can be redeemed from it and rescued from it, and one day the whole creation will be renewed and restored. The Buddhist says we are inherently perfect. We've lost touch with it through ignorance. We're deluded, we're attached, we crave, and we need to learn right-mindedness and enlightenment. That is the way to liberation. So healing comes in the Christian view by and through relationship and the gift of Christ's righteousness and perfection. Salvation in the Buddhist view comes through right thinking and going beyond thinking into an experience of inherent perfection. So just a little more on some of these phrases of attachment. They're saying that we have a need to hang on to, rely upon, or overly invest in things and people that ultimately are impermanent. And impermanence is this state of flux. No thing or event or person lasts forever. We are to go with the flow and not be attached or react. And here's a critical bit that we get into is, what is the self? There's no core self in the sort of heart of Buddhist philosophy. The sense of self and mind is a distortion of reality. If I have a quote here. Once we come, or for example, in relation to addiction, I am not my addiction. Once we come to mistake the self as somehow more real and enduring than it is, we have another problem on our hands. We spend much of our lives trying to fortify, defend, and aggrandize ourselves, fearing the failure to do so will result in our annihilation. Now that's true, isn't it? We would say that too. We spend a lot of our lives trying to make ourselves feel better through career, through money, through sexual contests, whatever it is. In the moment of grasping for something or pushing something away, the self as agent is created. A sought-after object is labeled mine in the act of acquiring it. whereas a resisted or rejected object is defined in one's mind as not mine. So grabbing hold of something or pushing something away means it's either mine or not mine. In both instances, the world of experience becomes intensely personalized. With this insight, the Buddhists are really offering a Copernican revolution to our understanding of selfhood and identity. This sort of, these quotes that I give you now, you don't see in all the literature and psychotherapy and mindfulness. It's the people who are more into the Buddhist aspects. So they would say there is no I to be found, just an unfolding moment-by-moment experience. We have many selves, thoughts, feelings, versus the Western idea of individualism and personal identity. Wai Wu Wei, who is a Buddhist monk who actually is American originally, but he's changed his name, says, "Why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one." A fluid identity. You're absolutely right. There's a sort of, yeah, you don't know who you are. Right. Let me give you another one. These differences are a fundamental point of departure between the two traditions. Because Western psychotherapy rests on the notion of a stable and cohesive self, it regards development and healing as processes of becoming. Becoming, well, less flawed, individuated, becoming someone. By contrast, Buddhist practice is about stopping our incessant efforts to firm up our sense of permanence and to rest in the uncertainty that we observe. It is to enable us to put to rest this need to become. Ultimately, you lose your individuality in the oneness of everything. So this Ron Siegel, who is an American, very much in the psychotherapy world, very influential, he says, when we relate to each moment as the impersonal unfolding of changing experience in the field of awareness, rather than my joy, my sorrow, we can face our adversity with less resistance. It's only my desires to be significant that's causing suffering. If I can embrace my insignificance, it's all okay. So as one of the 7 billion people alive here today on one tiny planet in a vast universe, we really are pretty darn insignificant. Now you can see how that is so totally opposite. I mean, there's one thing we do in our idolatries, want to make ourselves significant without God. Yeah. That's true. That's a lie. But the deepest thing is that God gives us profound significance in making us in his image, giving us a name, each individual identity, and says that your emotions, your thoughts, are profoundly significant. And I think we can engage with people who have this belief, not in an antagonistic way, but rather getting into conversation and maybe questioning some of the areas of inconsistency and tension with the reality of life. Ron Siegel says again, in the Buddhist traditions from which many contemporary mindfulness practices derive, mindfulness techniques evolved as tools for deconstructing our usual view of ourselves and the world, for waking up from conventional, socially reinforced fictions about who we are and how to find happiness. This awakening occurs to the degree that we no longer believe in the self. It involves realizing anatta, or non-self. Now I know I've heard this guy many times in webinars and things, and he's a very significant self. He's not a non-self. Which is really intriguing. So this sort of summary of identity and self, the Christian is created, named by a personal God. We are unique, we're valuable, we're loved, we are eternal. For the Buddhist, the self arises from attachment and delusion. From saying that something is mine, you're creating a self.
So there is a cross.
So there is this idea of dualistic thinking. We in the West think in terms of this and that, God and me, sin and righteousness, good and evil. In Eastern mysticism, in higher forms of Vedanta and Buddhist philosophy, you move beyond that, beyond good and evil, into what we call a monistic world where everything is one. That is very hard for our little minds, Western minds, to get around, because it's a different view, and you get there through the experience of meditation, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow, because our time is running out here for today. I'm just trying to remember where I've got to here. Yeah, I just want to go a little further before we finish. So what they would say is that you, through mindfulness and through Eastern meditation, you see the true essence of reality, which you're blind to most of the time by your dualistic concepts. So thinking interferes with getting there. So experience becomes much more important, the experience you have in meditation. It's what they would say, direct attention unmediated by language. And then mindfulness meditation has a quality of deep certainty and insistence that it is beyond refutation. So it's almost like you're beyond reason here, because reason doesn't matter anymore. You just have to know by experiencing. Now, most of the mindfulness practitioners are not going that far. They don't know about the depths of Buddhist philosophy in this way. But mindfulness leads you to insight. Insight leads to wisdom, to awakening. Greed, hatred, and delusion are eliminated. This is their goal. You're content with all circumstances, free of involuntary conditioning, and in no way driven into action by compulsion. Generosity, kindness, understanding emerge. You discover your true nature. And one of the things that they talk a lot about is, or two things, are gratitude and compassion. And as I finish, just to highlight the personal and the impersonal nature of this, they talk about being grateful, and as one critic, Ronald Aronson in the Philosopher's Magazine asked recently, thank whom very much? So if you're going to be grateful, gratitude obviously is good for you. It's just sort of, that's a sort of common, we know that from the beginning of our lives. And as Christians, it's a core part of who we are, to give thanks to the Lord, to be thankful to others. Gratitude exercises are great. Don't be anxious. By prayer, thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. So this is, I think, the core that we'll come back to again tomorrow. That it's the difference between ultimately an impersonal universe and a personal universe. And it's very difficult consistently to live in a universe that is utterly impersonal, where all is one. So most folk who are involved in Hinduism and Buddhism, I don't think can live consistently within that worldview. And that's the place of tension, where we have opportunities for apologetics and conversations. And here, the ultimate sort of goal is to become aware that you are God, but not a personal God, an impersonal force or something in the universe into which you... It's like they often say, it's the drop falling into the ocean, or the ocean falling into the drop.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate end of our identity.
Yeah.
So I hope that today you have I know it's taken us a little bit away from what you do in the counseling room with clients, but it's incredibly important that you're aware of where these ideas may take you. And as we think how we can redeem mindfulness, our task is to think a little bit more about that and how aspects of it are being used in contemplative prayer. And we'll talk about that, some of the practices you referred to, Marek, tomorrow, and some of the things we need to be cautious about in that area, because it's some Christians are using it in a way that is really unhelpful, much closer to an Eastern view.